Hi there, and welcome to Trillions, the show about the exchange-traded fund, better known as the ETF. I'm Joel Weber. I'm the editor of Bloomberg Markets Magazine.
And I'm Eric Balchunas, an analyst with Bloomberg Intelligence. Now on Trillions, we'll be talking about the ETF, which everybody has access to, but a lot of people don't really know what they are or how to use them.
And we're calling the show Trillions because of just how big ETFs are getting.
There are a lot of ways to describe the growth of ETFs. I think the most astonishing way is this bit of data here, which is that it took ETFs 18 years to get to $1 trillion in assets. But then it only took 4 years to get to $2 trillion. Now they've reached $3 trillion in just over 2 years, and they're headed to $4 trillion in just under 2 years.
So basically, these trillions are starting to stack up a little bit like Lego blocks, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, you've got trillion after trillion coming in, but and it sounds like, oh, there's this new financial industry thing that they're making a lot of money. And it's not true. Unlike hedge funds and mutual funds, which do produce a lot of money for the financial industry, nobody's getting rich on ETFs inside the financial industry. The investors are where the trillions are because ETFs hardly charge anything. So ultimately, those trillions are really investors taking their money back.
And when we talk about trillions, though, there is some projected growth of how big ETFs could get globally. Bullish case. How big are we talking?
Okay, so the most not sober case is $25 trillion by the year 2025. That's from State Street. That's crazy because there's only $4.5 trillion globally. So that would take a lot of things to fall into place. The more sober projections have them at $10 to $16 trillion in the U.S. alone in the next 10 years. Again, that would take some step-up years where you're seeing like literally a trillion flow in a year. But this year, we're almost going to have $500 billion come in, which is double almost the old record.
So any way you look at this, it starts to look like a hockey stick. And that growth is one of the things we're going to be talking about here on Trillions. So before we go any further, let's explain at the most basic level what an ETF is. Eric, I know that you like to say that an ETF is like a marriage between a stock, which is a share in a publicly traded company, and an index fund, which is basically a compilation of all those different stocks.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I teach the new classes on ETFs here to new hires, and everybody can identify with that. You show a picture of a stock in an index fund, and because, look, a lot of products that people love and know came from two things getting combined. And so it makes sense. Sometimes you bring two things together, you get something better in the end.
1 + 1 = 3.
Yeah, basically. I mean, take, for example, the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup, chocolate and peanut butter, right? I know you like those.
God, I love those, yeah.
Or, I mean, your favorite band, Hall & Oates, right? You got Hall & Oates. They are really bad individually. Yeah. You put them together, you've got like 20 hit songs.
So much better together than apart.
Yeah, throw in the mustache and you got like basically a gold mine.
The mustache was just gold. So what are the advantages of the marriage in the context of an ETF?
So the good stuff people like about stocks, right? You like it's easy to trade. There's price transparency. It's convenient, right? The stuff that people like about index funds is they're cheap and they're diversified. So you get a lot of stocks in one shot.
Right. Let's actually dwell on that diversification idea for a little bit longer. I like to think of diversification like a carton of eggs, right? So there's 12. Maybe you drop that carton and you break one. But you haven't ruined the whole carton, right? You still have 11 others that are perfectly good. Is that a little bit like what an ETF is?
Yeah, my wife would still yell at me for the one that broke. But my issues aside, yes, that's a great way to put it. I'm a fan of metaphors, and I think you just nailed it there. That's exactly what diversification does for you.
So as simple as I think that sounds, I want you to try and explain it to our producer, who we've hired because she actually knows nothing about ETFs. Jordan, can you hear us?
That's right. I can hear you, and I don't know anything about ETFs, you know.
Jordan is basically our audience.
Yeah, totally. So let's actually like try and explain it to Jordan, Eric. What's an example that you like to use when you're explaining what an ETF is?
Okay. So, Jordan, let's create a scenario here, okay? Let's say you live out in the suburbs, right, and you walk outside and you see somebody putting solar panels up on their roof across the street.
Which, Jordan, you're from California.
Yeah.
Maybe you've seen that before.
I have. Oh, I've seen it go down.
Yeah. There's solar streets there, right? Yeah. So anyway, you see solar or something going up and you say to yourself, you know, I'm seeing a lot of this. This is something I'd like to invest in. Now, you don't even know any solar stocks. I don't. Who does, right? So how would you go about doing that? You'd have to go research the stocks and all this. Already you'd be like, you know what? I'm late for the bus. the hell with it. Well, ETFs make that very easy because, like, take the solar energy ETF, has the ticker TAN.
Which is one of the best parts about ETFs are these crazy names, yeah. Like TAN.
Not all the tickers are that good, but that one's right up there. But TAN, easy to remember. But look, TAN, what it does is it serves up 30 solar stocks in one shot. TAN does all that work. You buy TAN and then you own those 30 stocks at once. And TAN's actually a really good example to explain diversification because in 2014, there was a stock inside TAN called GT Advanced Technologies. And it declared bankruptcy after Apple had decided not to use some of their glass in one of the iPhone 6 screens. So the stock dropped 87% in one day. So Jordan, if you had picked that stock, you would be sucking wind, basically.
Oh my gosh.
But that only contributed to negative 1% of TAN's performance. So in other words, TAN barely felt it because it was just one of 36 stocks. And that essentially is why you want to be diversified.
So you avoided the huge risk of a single stock blowing up, but you also gave something up too, right?
Yeah. So this is why stock picking will probably never die as an art form because, Jordan, let's say you bought SolarCity a couple years back and that went up 240% in a year. And that year, TAN only went up 87%. So that's the downside is you aren't going to sort of win the lottery if you pick the right stock. So it's almost like passive investing and diversification is you saying, you know what, I'd rather give up a potential home run to ensure I don't strike out.
Which passive investing, ETFs are mostly passive. It's also worth noting that that stock got booted out of TAN.
Yeah, so after it declared bankruptcy, it was gone within a couple days. That's the thing with ETFs. They track indexes, and those indexes have all these rules that look for certain requirements. So if a stock gets weak, or declares bankruptcy, or just starts lagging and becomes a bad actor, it's going to get kicked out of the index and replaced by a stronger up-and-comer. So there's a regeneration process to the index, so you don't have to do any work. So even though you picked it, it's not just those 36 stocks stuck in time. They actually change and regenerate over time so that you don't have to worry about it.
So Jordan, do you have a little bit better sense of what ETFs are about now?
Yeah, I can get an ETF in something I'm interested in, but I, you know, diffuse my risk because of how they're set up, but I also forego my chance at hitting it real big.
There you go.
She said diffuse my risk. I think she knows more than we think. That's pretty good. Did you just pick that up from our little discussion?
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, we're on the right track,
Joel. I'm a quick learner.
So Jordan now understands what an ETF is, and she understands what TAN is, but TAN's like a really small niche player here, right? Like, let's talk about like the rest of the ETF landscape.
Yeah, totally. TAN is, yeah, niche is the right word. But it's just good for a scenario, you know, solar energy, everybody. And she, you know, Jordan's a millennial, so I figured she'd respond to that. And she did. Anyway, but most of the money is going into what we call in the analyst world, plain vanilla ETFs. Mm. TAN would be like Rocky Road, a little more exotic, a little more volatile. But most of the money goes into stuff like ETFs that just basically track the S&P 500.
Yeah, there's a couple of those, right?
Yeah, there's a couple of those.
Called like SPY and
yeah, SPY, IVD. Spider has one. Yeah. BlackRock has one. Their brand is called iShares. And Vanguard has one. Most people out there probably know Vanguard at this point. Vanguard's a pretty big player in the ETF space. They are only plain vanilla. BlackRock does a little of both, and same with State Street. But like, take the S&P 500 ETFs. They collectively account for nearly one-fifth of all ETF assets. That's how popular they are. And there's 2,100 ETFs. So
just buying the S&P 500, that's like 20% of what these things are doing.
I mean, that's what Warren Buffett says to do. I mean, just buying the S&P 500 is arguably the most popular investment move right now.
And are these buy and hold investments or are people trading them?
Good question. So SPY, which is the Spider product, that was the first ETF, that one has a lot of liquidity. It trades a lot. So that one's used a little more from like for traders going in and out of the S&P 500. BlackRock and Vanguard's are a little more used by buy and hold investors. They're also a little cheaper. You know, the low expense ratio attracts more of the buy and hold investors. But ultimately, all three could be used to hold 20 years if you wanted or 20 minutes.
And how cheap are these things? And let's kind of use a real number. I'm going to say I have $10,000, right?
Sure.
How much does this actually cost me?
Right. So say you have $10,000. If you put that into SPY, they would basically take out $9.50 a year. If you put it into VOO, which is the Vanguard, they take out $5 a year. And if you put it into IVV, they take out $4 a year. So we're talking about, you know, a slice of pizza, you know.
Two slices of pizza, maybe.
Not in Penn Station, but yeah, depends on where
you
go. You
don't want to eat that pizza anyway.
That's true.
Yeah. So for a couple slices of pizza, you can have the whole entire stock market. That's a revolutionary moment.
Totally. That is why these are powerful, you know, explosive tools that are sweeping the nation, literally.
So you don't have to go out there and buy 500 individual stocks and then try and, like, manage that portfolio. You get one thing.
Yeah. And, you know, when I wrote this book on ETFs, the word that kept coming back to when I spoke to a lot of people about the advantages was convenience. And ultimately, I went through advantages of ETFs, and at the end, I'm like, it's really convenience. I mean, cost is a big one, but, you know, people love things that are convenient. Any business, if you can serve up convenience and make life easier, I mean, look at Amazon. I mean, it's not like anything you get on there you can't get anywhere else. It's just convenient.
Right.
And ETFs ultimately provide convenience, you know, in multiple times over.
So we talked about the plain vanilla side of the ETF world. What are some other sides?
Right. So you got bonds, right? So bond market's a huge thing. And there's, I would consider, a few plain vanilla bond ETFs, some that just give you, like, all bonds sort of all collectively. Then there's things that are a little more risky, like high yield debt. You know, some people call them junk bonds. There's an ETFs for that. Then you've got areas like commodities. A big ETF in the commodity space is GLD, which basically, you know, you think S&P 500 is convenient. GLD essentially gives you exposure to a bunch of bars of gold sitting in a storage facility. So it's like having a way to own gold without having to pay insurance, you know, or to worry about anybody stealing it.
Own a vault, right? No need to own a vault. You can just own a little bit of an ETF.
Yeah. I mean, you're essentially buying shares in physically backed gold. So there's basically, in GLD's case, the gold is stored in London. So there's a guy there with a machine gun probably, like, standing outside the vault. I'm not sure if that's true, but I imagine that's true. But anyway, it's in a bank.
It's a good mental image.
Let's just say it's secure, okay?
Yeah.
You know, this isn't like, you know, the Pink Panther where a group of bandits are going to be able to get in there and steal it. But ultimately, and I hope one day we can go look at the gold.
Oh, I'm going to,
you know,
that
now that we're,
call.
Yeah, we have this podcast, maybe they'll let us look at it. And then we can interview the gold.
Yeah. Silence. Yeah. That's what it's going to sound like.
Yeah.
It's going to be awesome. So that's all domestic stuff here in the U.S. What about international?
So international's a growing area, definitely. And what I find interesting about ETFs internationally is a lot of them, I mean, they all hold local shares in local markets. I mean, you used to need a broker to get, say, like, local Egyptian stocks, right? ETFs do that for you. So even institutions use ETFs for international play. But mostly the big plain vanilla international ones are, for example, international developed, which essentially is the countries that are more developed, like European countries and Japan. They all package that in one ETF. Vanguard has a couple. BlackRock has a couple. Then you could look at something like emerging markets. Those are a little more risky, but you package all of them together. You get countries like China, right? Brazil, and some of them South Korea. And they put all those together. And then you can go further out. There's frontier market ETFs. Those are countries that are, like, on the, like, JV of development.
And
they're not even emerging yet.
And
so,
the difference between that emerging markets and that frontier markets is pretty amazing for the countries that are in them.
You have countries that are, like, you know, really out there, like Kenya and Vietnam, and there's ETFs that serve that up. And there's, you know, there's an ETF that tracks Africa, like all the stocks that are in African countries. So you go down the list, I mean, you throw out a country, I can tell you how to play with ETFs. It's basically the whole world. Picture is like, remember the game Risk?
Oh, yeah.
You know, you put your little men all over, or Monopoly, whatever. The whole world has been ETFized. So if you want, say, France, how do you want it? You want individual France ETF? Do you want a Eurozone ETF? Do you want a pan-European ETF? Or do you want that in international developed? So it goes from more, you know, very narrow to more general and everything in between. And now they'll do ones where it's like, oh, we'll give you French stocks, but we'll weight them by their fundamentals.
So I think when the average investor hears something like ETF, not only do they get a little confused, but they also get a little scared, because the financial industry is really good at coming up with scary acronyms, things like CDOs that almost brought down the world with the financial crisis. So they hear ETF, and it's yet one more thing. So even though this thing has grown so rapidly, I think there is still this apprehension around, here's this thing from the financial world. Should I trust it?
That's a completely fair feeling for people to have, and I feel the same way. I think the thing with ETF, though, is, and again, like you said, this is this acronym really the greatest name ever? Maybe not, but the F is key. It's a fund. It's a mutual fund. In fact, ETFs are registered with the SEC under the same act as mutual funds. You know, some people call them mutual funds with benefits. And ultimately, that's important to understand because they are not derivatives. They are actually funds. They just happen to trade on the exchange. Their shares do. And so I think that's a key point to feeling safer about using them, is that they are fiduciary vehicles approved by the SEC. Although I should just sort of evolve what I just said to say that there are some types of products at the fringes, right? What I just described is basically 90% of the ETF assets. There's some stuff at the fringes, stuff that, say, tracks oil futures or three times leveraged ETFs. Those are they don't have much in assets, but they do get a lot of attention. But those are not registered under the 40 Act. Those would be called exchange-traded vehicles or you know, ETPs. Those are a little different, and they sort of got under the same sort of tent of ETF. But ultimately, I think for most investors, they're going to use these, you know, the plain vanilla ETFs to get exposures that are more normal. But, you know, you will find some investors will be curious and maybe go outside of that. But those are the areas where I think, especially on this podcast, we'll let you know why there's some areas in ETFs that are dangerous where you could lose money. I mean, I'm developing a rating system, and I talked about this in my book, where if you rated ETFs like movies, you'd ultimately find there are some R-rated ETFs. The bulk of the assets and the bulk of the ETFs would be PG and G, but they do go into some areas that are a little more risky.
And this is where the buyer beware thing comes in, because you ultimately sort of need to know what you're buying. And the risk here is that everything kind of looks the same.
Yeah, and the idea that the whole market has become so easy to buy, no matter what corner of the market you want, it's as easy to buy as clicking buy on Microsoft shares. I agree. There is some degree of maybe that's made stuff that's more dangerous seem less dangerous. But again, I take a step back from this because if you look at the assets in ETFs, that $3 trillion, almost every dime of it is in stuff that is not dangerous. It's just, you know, plain vanilla. It's like stuff mutual funds hold. But yeah, at the fringes, there are some products that are beloved by people who use them. You know, stuff that tracks the VIX, stuff that tracks oil futures. Yeah, there's some stuff that, you know, you might not even heard of that some ETFs track. But ultimately, I think that's why it's important to look at those, but they are the exception, not the norm.
So ultimately, ETFs just made things really easy because you can do all these things that used to be really complicated, and now you can just do it on a button on your smartphone.
You know, yeah, it kind of reminds me, there's a phrase out there, fast, good, cheap, and they say that as a consumer, you can only get two of those three things, right? So something's fast and good, it's not cheap. It's cheap and fast, it's not good, and so on. And I think, you know, I feel like the, you know, there's a couple things that basically blow that rule away and give you all three at once.
Drum roll.
So one thing, just personal to me, is Vietnamese restaurants.
Oh, okay.
They really are fast, good, and cheap.
Yep.
And ETFs, I do believe they deliver all three of those things in almost every case. Not every, but that to me, again, and this goes back to when I got them in 2006. After you start sniffing around them and you kick the tires on them, you realize, you know, they're a special kind of structure.
So, Eric, we've talked about the growth of ETFs. We've talked about what these things look like and what's in them. We've talked about the risks. We broke it down for Jordan. Where are we going?
This is a question I ponder a lot. I think, you know, when you look at the future of the whole enchilada, right? I think you're just going to see more and more investors demanding free exposure, basically, or low, low cost to the point where it's free. So I think one evolutionary line of ETF growth is going to be what we call a race to the bottom. And the bottom being good here means zero fees. Right now, like we said, ETFs are 3, 4, 5, maybe 6 basis points, especially in the plain vanilla categories. You know, those are being driven down. They were 14 basis points.
Not so long ago, right?
Yeah. In fact, they did a study over at ETF.com that showed that the cheapest ETF portfolio drops by a basis point a year. So right now it's at 0.06%, meaning you can get a whole fully diversified portfolio of ETFs for 0.06% all in. That drops a basis point a year. So that puts us on track to have free exposure in the next 5 or 6 years. And I think most people think that's going to happen. And that's a beautiful thing. I mean, think about that concept. That is going to upend the entire financial system. You think, you know, Bernie Sanders, he probably wouldn't even imagine how much this is going to change things and likely probably just going to shrink Wall Street to a degree, because there'll just be way less money. The retail host organism is going to be tiny if people keep going to that point. And the people issuing the ETFs are dropping the fees. Why? Because people are buying the cheaper ones. If a ETF, for example, goes from tied for the cheapest to the cheapest, I've seen it happen. Billions will go to the cheaper one.
We're talking like almost nothing. Like
one basis point.
Almost, right?
Yeah, it's people are cost obsessed. And even we're talking to people who might not even know much about ETFs. Something shifted back in the 90s and 80s. It was all about the hot manager, the five-star manager. You know, you talk about at a party, hey, I picked the best stock or I have the best manager. That's changing. Now you go, people are bragging about how low cost their portfolio is and how cheap they're getting things. So I think that there's a cost obsession that is just going to continue to drive fees lower on the plain vanilla side.
Right.
And ultimately, that's going to be very tough if you're in the financial industry, but it's going to be wonderful if you're an investor.
So great for investors, and you've got that pressure pushing on this, what you'll call like an evolutionary line. There's this whole other evolutionary line, though. What do you see over there?
So in the plain vanilla category, I just think a lot of investors are just not satisfied with, say, a couple, you know.
Buying the stock market. It's like, okay.
Yeah, okay, so I got the S&P, I got a bond index, and, you know, that's good, and arguably, if you just hold that for 20 years, you'll probably do better than everybody, but people are itchy. They want to outperform. They want to try to do better. So there's a whole group of ETFs being launched that allow you to try to outperform using strategies, right? They're packaging trades. You've got themes. And that's, for an analyst, that's where the fun stuff is, to be honest with you. I like covering all the new stuff they're launching. And over there, you can charge a little more. Because if your goal is to kind of beat the market or provide some exotic exposure, something that's new and fresh, ultimately, people are willing to pay a little more. But even fees are still coming down over there. But ultimately, I think that is where you'll see sort of a lot of the other, like you'll see some really wild stuff being launched into ETFs. In fact, this year's satire is tomorrow's new ETF.
For instance, let's talk about whiskey.
Yeah,
right?
There's a whiskey ETF, which essentially is tracking stocks that are in the whiskey production. But, you know, honestly about whiskey, even though it sounds silly, there is a fundamental story there. If you look at the stock prices of some of these liquor companies, they've been doing pretty well. There's a global demand for alcohol. And the guy who started the whiskey ETF is from Lexington, Kentucky. He's around that industry. So even the gimmicky ones, it's funny, you start to unpeel a little bit and you realize there's somebody who really believes in that industry, somebody who thinks there's a fundamental story. But on its surface, do you really need a whiskey ETF in your portfolio? That's where people think it's gimmicky. You don't need it. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, that's an example, I think, of the kind of thematic ETFs that you see launching a lot more lately.
That's one of the things that I think is so fascinating about this particular space is that a lot of these things just started with somebody having an idea.
Yeah, I was just talking to the guy who launched the reverse market cap weighted ETF, which essentially weights the lowest stock in the S&P 500 with the biggest weighting. And he said he just got the idea. And then he back-tested it, looked good, and so he launched an ETF. Ultimately, this is what I love about the ETF industry. It is the Silicon Valley of the financial world right now. This is where all the innovation's happening, from big companies like JP Morgan and Goldman, as well as small independent issuers. I call them the indie guys, sort of like indie rock.
Love it.
Yeah, these are independent issuers. A big indie one that's been hit it big was the Robo, which is the robotics industry. That ETF is now almost $2 billion. And it just had a good idea. These stocks weren't really represented in other benchmarks. And then it outperformed like a madman. And ultimately, it is interesting seeing some of these smaller, niche-y, independent ones actually work out for investors. And ultimately, I think the idea of outperforming or having something that's got a little extra juice in it, that will never die. Performance chasing is as old as, you know, the world. And you're going to have people who performance chase. And that's why there won't only be the plain vanilla side. You'll also have this side with people packaging everything they can into an ETF. And we just saw one that was coming out. I call them package trades. There's ones that will go long, say, local stocks and then short the currency. And a good example of one that packaged an actual trade was Clix. It goes long online retailers like Amazon and short brick and mortar stores like Sears and JCPenney. And that, you know, again, you could do that on your own, but now they're doing it for you. So now you see trades being packaged into an ETF or strategies like value or momentum. There is so much going on. It's fascinating. And you see about four ETFs launch a day in the world and about one in the US. So every day there's something coming out. I mean, ultimately, just like apps, you know, there's all these apps coming out because the iPhone is bringing this to people. All the money's going into ETFs, right? So that's why you see a lot of innovation. And on the side that's more, that does more niche stuff, most of those are going to fail. There's, you know, a lot of them will just not have any buyers. But for every 20 that fail, there'll be a robotics ETF or a cybersecurity ETF that gets $1 billion. And that's going to keep this independent spirit, which I think is healthy for the industry. But at the end of the day, the big money, the real money, it's going to go to Vanguard, BlackRock, State Street, and the plain vanilla stuff that costs almost nothing.
Which brings us back to trillions, because that's how much money is actually pouring into these things. Thanks for listening to Trillions.
Until next time, you can find us on the Bloomberg Terminal, the Bloomberg app, Bloomberg.com, as well as on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and probably a few other things I don't know about yet. While you're there, take a minute to rate and review the show. It helps other people find us. We're also on Twitter and would love to hear from you. I'm at Joel Weber Show. He's at Eric Balchunas.
Trillions is produced by Jordan Bell with help from Magnus the Swede Hendrickson. Francesca Levy is the head of Bloomberg Podcasts.
Bye.